Well, sometimes they have to kill us. They have to kill us. Because they can't break our spirit.
Look, I don't have to do this.
You don't have any choice.
I'm trying to help you people. Now, why won't you accept that?
It's in our DNA. You have to do what old man says.
What makes you such a threat?
We choose the right to be who we are. We know the difference between the reality of freedom and the illusion of freedom. There's a way to live with Earth and a way not to live with Earth. We choose the way of Earth. It's about power, Ray.
Friends, this is your co-host, Will Bluewater. Join us now to learn how to legally worship using indigenous earth-based healing and empowering ceremonies. Aho. As Bluewater, seventh great-grandson of Old Tassel, first beloved man of the Cherokee, I'm remembering what Old Tassel said to the prevailing culture. Many proposals have been made to us to adopt your laws, your religion, your manners, and your customs. We have done so. Now it is time for our cultures to accept Old Tassel's ways and assisting us to walk in harmony with Mother Earth and Father Sky. Aho.
Grandfather, teach me the ways of the old, so that I may remember who I am.
And good evening, everybody. Another Sunday night has rolled around. Our guest, Ramala Vansantha Thumbadu, the legacy keeper of William Commando, will be calling in pretty soon. But while we're waiting for her, I understand Mark did a Mayan birth reading on Mad Bear. Have you got that handy? I forgot to mention to you.
Oh, well, you remember his birth date? I forgot. I could look it up real quick. Let me see.
Caught me flat for this. I don't think I ever knew what it was, and I
oh,
caught.
Oh, I'll find it. I know. I'll find it. Just give me a second. I have it here somewhere.
We caught each other flat-footed.
And there. Let me see. Yeah. There. Oh yeah. Here we go. I knew it was in November. So let's see. November 9th.
Scorpio.
1927. So, yeah, his traditional Mayan day count was he was a Chuen, 11 bats. So that's kind of a playful person that likes to mess with the illusion of things.
Uh huh.
That's kind of fits. Person would be inclined. They could do a lot of fun stuff with magical, mystical stuff. I can have fun with it in a good way. Let me see what the other one says about him, because that's the one where I saw something that was interesting. I saw connections on in Sixth Sun. I saw some connections actually to you and to Mac Boogaloo. Both. Trying to figure out what yours was, because I don't know what else. God, what was it now? Man, where did I see that? I'm going to have to scan through a couple things here to find it.
If you want to do that later, our guest has called in. Do you want to postpone that? You want to just do that? Okay.
We can forget it and do it another time, maybe.
You bet. No problem. Well, folks, we're welcoming Romola Vasatha Thumbadou to the program. She's a legacy keeper for William Commando. How are you this evening?
Oh, I'm very well, thanks. Thank you very much for inviting me to talk about Grandfather Commander.
Well,
we're
doing very well. I didn't get a chance to ask you beforehand. We like to do a Mayan glyph birth reading for our guests with their permission, and the problem is sometimes they don't want to reveal their full birth date, or sometimes they don't want their Mayan glyph revealed. Would you like to do that here and now?
Sure, that sounds very interesting.
Okay, so can you tell Mark your full birth date?
Okay, it's the 11th of January, 1952.
Okay.
January 11th, 1952. Okay.
Yeah, the Mayan birth reading will give you quite a bit of insight. Our guests are always just really astounded at how much it confirms in their own mind that it kind of tells them why they do what they do. And I think you really enjoy it. Yeah,
because I'm quite often confused about why I do what I do.
Really?
Yeah,
that happens too.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, ready on it. So you were born on a kind of an interesting day of the Mayan Zolcan calendar and the traditional day count. You were born actually on the very last day of the Mayan Zolcan, called 13 Ahau. And the number 13 has meanings like it kind of relates to like the base of the pyramid where the pyramid connects to the ground, right?
Okay.
And it carries with it some energies of things about realization of things and changing things, transmuting things, moving things along from one thing to another and that, and usually in a good way. The number 13 also usually indicates the higher the number of Joe, the Mayan elders usually say that indicates more power, too. So, kind of powerful. The Ahau glyph is actually the glyph of the sun.
Oh,
so,
really?
Or grandfather's son.
Okay.
And so it would, so the two connect together to kind of be about, you know, sun's transmutation of things with the power and the energy of the sun. And a lot of, even scientists, I think, now realize that, you know, well, where did all the stuff come from in our local system? It probably originates with the sun.
Right.
And, yeah. And then in the Mayan things, they actually look at and say all the stars or suns are all connected by web works and like almost like a tube system, a subway system, or a shuttle system, or a spider web, or a tunnel system, or something like a subway system. And they actually can go into a, some of them, I don't know if all the clans and tribes do this, but they can go into a certain meditation and literally go out of body, go into the sun, and then travel from one sun star to the next.
Oh,
they
wow.
have a name for it. I can't pronounce it in their language, but they have a name for actually those energy webs or tunnels that light connections from one star to the next. So that might be something you might be good at.
That's very interesting, because you may or may not know that William Commander's Algonquin name is Ojigwanong, and it means morning.
Yeah. Morning star. Yeah.
Yeah.
It would connect into, because in the Maya tradition, morning star was very important. It's directly associated with Quetzalcoatl and his passing when he left, and he was burned on a funeral pyre or something. And in that story, he actually left, went up, and actually some of the stories said he became the morning star. Other ones just said he is associated with it. So there's actually some traditions that say the morning star is also an important gateway in our system. And it actually rotates the opposite direction than all the other planets. All the other ones are going clockwise, or no, counterclockwise. And it is actually, Earth and all the other planets are going counterclockwise. It is going clockwise. It's the only planet that does that in our solar system. So there's some unusual things about it. But there are some stories I've heard from different things that indicate it has connections from the morning star planet up into different star systems. Some say Sirius. That was the main one. Sometimes you hear Arcturus, but Sirius, I think, especially, Sirius B, I think? One of the planets that are orbiting Sirius B. It's a very large planet, and it's mainly water.
Okay.
It's basically a water world. It supposedly has cetacean life on it, dolphins
uh-huh.
up there. So maybe William's hanging out with them. His personality seems to fit pretty well with dolphins.
he went to Japan, I think it would have been maybe 97, and did a big prayer. He went to the Funai conference, and he did a big prayer for the dolphins and the whales at that time. It was really, really, really big on his mind. After that, of course, there were lots of losses in terms of all that sea life. So he was planting his prayer in the right place.
Well, we'll finish up on your reading here. We're going to switch gears and we're going to go to the sixth dimensional. And it has three components to it. The forward flow of time, the backward flow of time.
Okay.
When two time flows come together and unify and create a balance or a zero point. That would be also kind of a gateway between worlds or even going into like spirit world, sort of symbolic a connection there. So forward flow is the way we normally perceive time. Our senses, normal senses, don't perceive the backward flow. However, psychics and stuff can pick up on the backward flow, but not with our normal five senses. We don't usually detect it. So on the forward flow, this is kind of going from your birth forward, right?
Okay.
So it's indicating things about connecting and binding wisdom. A lot of things about opening up paths, using free will, especially for things of service to other people, groups and such. It does seem to have a connection here into a lot of our guests do actually into the star system of the Pleiades as kind of a background in music, I guess you call a chorus or some partnering duet, partner or whatever, some kind of partnering energy, right? That's working. So it may not be directly where you are connected into, but it may be something that's running parallel to and helping, kind of like guardian spirit or something. it's especially involved in things about heart and dogs. You know, if you see dog energy, and in the Mayan tradition, one of the dogs, Xolotl, is Quetzalcoatl's partner. He's the dog that helps guide the souls through the underworld after they die. So that might be something interesting to you. On the backward flow, this is things that may be showing up in your life more recently. Usually seems to be a lot of times with people around 1997, 98, maybe a little bit before, maybe a little bit after, but somewhere around that time, this type of stuff may have been showing up in your life. And this is on the backward flow time, coming from what we think of as the next world cycle. And it's about instinct. Teaching things about instinct, life force, sacred power, community, cooperation in a community, and giving birth to those type of things. birthing communities and cooperation in the community and those people learning how to, in that community and stuff, how to use sacred power, instinct, to survive sometimes, and natural ways of things. It has kind of a, it's sitting inside of a cycle, is a peace cycle. So the community is probably going to be also have a very strong component of peace. So where these two come together in the balance or zero point area, the two time flows, it's showing up here as peace again. Specifically, not just peace, but the peace is coupled with a spiraling radial type of light that forms our creation. So this is a fundamental aspect of how Creator forms our reality. And the way we could sort of describe it to most people might understand it is the way a hologram is made, where you have a laser, breaks it apart, creates two lights, creates an interference pattern, and it looks three-dimensional. And it's sort of the same idea, not exactly the same, but the key part of that is that the thing that builds that hologram is a laser light. And in laser light, all of the photons are working together. They're dancing in the same song. They're all singing and doing exactly the same thing. None of them's doing something different. They're all working together. What you call, in scientific terms, you call it coherency.
Okay.
So in your thing, what that indicates is your pathway that gets you from where you are and bridges the time flows and gets from one world cycle to the next, bridges the spirit world back to here and all that, basically has to do with how that light and stuff creates our reality and how it relates to having a peaceful reality. So yes. I would not be surprised if that is a fairly significant thing to you in your life, is something moving in direction of community peace, learning how to essentially tap into Creator, how Creator forms things and consciousness of Creator and how that works in the reality, and how that, if we do that too and we're working with it, just like all those photons in that laser beam are working together,
mm-hmm.
then we're working in unity. And I believe that's part of, that goes back to what William Commanda, the circle of all nations.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Wow. Well, it's very interesting you mention 97, because that was the year I actually met him.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And, shifted my focus in you know, very considerable ways. Yeah. So,
pretty much opened a completely new path, right?
Yeah, I'd say yeah. It kind of dragged me into a whole new path. Yeah. And, of course, he has been gone the last few years, and so it's been difficult walking that path it's been very challenging. So it's interesting that we see peace emerging at some point.
Yeah, it's actually in yours and here in several places, actually.
Uh-huh.
It's a yeah. Well, I'm thinking that his thing probably he might be the Pleiadian part of your influence I was talking about earlier. Yeah, that's a good chance. But you know, you can kind of still keep in touch with him, you know.
No, he's, I feel like he's very close to me all the time, and I think, I feel like he's still giving me many orders. and bossing me around indirectly.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, I do actually feel very close to him.
Yeah, good.
Yeah.
Well, maybe you should tell us, maybe a good place to start back when you first met him back in 1997, how things got started.
Okay, well, again, thank you for your interest in both William and in hearing me talk a little bit about him. I myself was born in South Africa, came to North America, to Canada in 1970, went to school, studied literature, ended up working in the criminal justice system, worked across the country in prisons and parole for many, many years. And then during the decade before I met William, I became involved in Aboriginal justice. And I was organizing many conferences with elders across Canada to advance better relations between Native people and representatives from the justice system. And then one of my conferences, I asked Grandfather Commander to help support our effort. And so, yeah, I met him on the 11th of April in 1997. I guess I must have organized a good conference, because then he invited me to this gathering that he hosted at his home in Maniwaki. At first, I was, at this stage, I was a bureaucrat of, 15 to 18 years, and I was rather scared of going to a gathering of a bunch of strange people. And so initially, I was a little bit reluctant to head into the spiritual experience. And when I said, I'm not really sure if I can go, his initial response was, it was like a $64 question why I'd go. But a week before his gathering, he invited me again, and I was still hedging, but he said, anyone can learn, you know. So I rented a station wagon, put my foam headboard into it, bought granola bars, and went camping. And I say, Grandfather ensured that I didn't go and park in the far back parking lot, miles away. And I ended up being at his home. And then I, over the course of this three-day spiritual gathering with the people camping on his property, people from all over the world, I began to realize just how much more than justice this man was attempting to do. So gradually then, over the next few months, I began to understand better his work with respect to the constant prayer for Mother Earth, for promoting racial harmony. I actually at this stage live in Ottawa, the capital city, but his home was an hour and a half away from the capital. As he had worked in the city, I ended up driving him around, and I gradually began to understand much better the strong indigenous spirit and the strong spiritual prominence of this very, very unusual elder. As I say, at this stage, I had already been working with, Native elders across the country for quite a few years, so I knew many of them, respected many of them, cared very much for many of them, and learned so much. But William Commander was just quite a bit different. And after a couple of years of driving him around, partly I was able to do that because I took a leave of, I went on secondment from justice to do some restorative justice work. During that time, I was able to drive him around more and take him to some of his meetings and get a better sense of his priorities. And then I thought, maybe I'd take early retirement and look to supporting some of his work. Initially, I didn't see how I could afford to do that, but at a particular point, I kind of thought it through again, and then that's what I did. I took early retirement from the federal government, and that was it. I became very intimately involved in every aspect of his life. I supported his work, and I think at this stage, he was quite determined to imprint everything that every memory, every thought that was of importance to him in my mind, so that I would understand and help to articulate his work. And so that process, I find, is still ongoing. So that's sort of like, a little background to how I became involved with William Commander's work.
Oh, it's fascinating.
Oh.
So, yeah.
So what
now,
kind of...
would it make...
Oh, go ahead, I'm
for
sorry.
...for me to tell you a little bit about him?
Oh, please do.
Or
yeah, we try not to interrupt, and so if after you say something, and if there's a long lag... We're waiting for opportunity to say something, but please do, as the spirit dictates, tell us whatever you think that the Creator wants us to hear, please.
Okay, and then by all means interrupt me if you think, you need to know or are interested in anything in particular at any point. Okay, so then let me say... William Commander was actually born on the 11th of November, 1913. And the morning star was shining when he made his first cry, he says. So his mother called him Ojigwanong. He knew that time so precisely because the railway had just started moving into his community, to Maniwaki. And so as the train tooted its horn, so did William make his first cry. And it's kind of a sweet memory because, we celebrated his birthdays. He died at the age of 98. And if he happened to be awake earlier, he wasn't ready quite to be greeted for his birthday at 7 o'clock. He was always waiting for the 8 o'clock moment. It's a particularly meaningful moment, that 11th of November 1913, when he was born, because it ends up being the eve of the First World War. And so as his life evolved and as I look back on his life, I see he was really a very bright light in a world that was getting increasingly dark. And as his life passed on, I think he sort of shone a very, very bright torch for peace in a century of tremendous change in the life of his people and really all of us globally. Is the Algonquin of the Ottawa River watershed. He described himself as Mamiwinini, nomad. And for him, that idea of nomad meant that his people moved every day. They walked every day. They canoed every day. The heritage of the Algonquin people is very much rooted in the birch bark canoe. And they created the this canoe and navigated the waterways of North America from really time immemorial. William's uncle was a canoe maker of renown. All Algonquins created canoes, and many of them were like practical vessels for movement. but his uncle was an artist. So he taught the young child, William, how to craft canoes in a very special way. This included securing the winter bark, the winter birch bark, and the winter bark can be etched upon. So William Commander's canoes have imprints, sketches, or really etchings of symbols of the natural world that were important to him. This includes stars, moose, wolves, animal world representation. I should explain that a little better. He created pencils, and then you scrape out the design, and so you have a lighter bark and a redder bark, and this is how you see these images. So he became a canoe maker of great renown. During his childhood, making just a little canoe, selling them to tourists, gave him a great sense of independence. And in his later years, he taught his grandchildren canoe making, teaching them kind of like both an art and craft and spiritual connection with the elements of the earth, as well as providing them with an opportunity for security. He, when he was in his 80s, actually went to Denmark and built a birch bark canoe for Queen Margarita. And in another interesting way for me, it's the completion of a certain cycle within the rhythm of his life. He was very conscious of the presence of the Vikings in North America, and of course, not all those memories were good ones in the history of his people. So when he eventually met Queen Margarita, he had an opportunity to talk to her for a couple of hours, and he said, "You know, she held my hand with no gloves." He was pointing out to the relationship building that was eventually happening with the first occupiers of North America. His canoes are at the Canadian Canoe Museum, and so, yeah, that was one huge and special part of his heritage. It is also an important heritage in terms of the journey of life. And so the symbolic significance of that and how it guided him through his life is really, really very interesting. He, quite a few years after I met him, decided one day that he was going to get me a kayak. And it was really interesting learning experience for me. At this point, we were supposed to be doing some research to protest the establishment of a mega dump near a lake. And I, as I said earlier, came from the criminal justice system and didn't really know all that much about the environment. So I felt like I needed to study mega dumps so that we could know how to voice our concerns properly. Well, William decided that that was the day we were going to get me a kayak. And so I kind of sort of decided in the end that I would humor him, take him out for a little jaunt around town. I ended up with this kayak, which we took to his home in Maniwaki and put it in the lake. So now I'm wondering what I was supposed to do and waiting for some instructions. He was busy, not paying too much of attention to me, so I decided that I would just get into the kayak because I figured it couldn't be that difficult. Well, I put one foot in and discovered just how difficult that could be because the kayak flipped, dumped me into what I considered this froggy water that I had sort of like not put a toe into over all those years I'd visited his lake. And there you go. I was immersed in the lake. So I went off kayaking, and over the course of the summer, I found that I just couldn't keep away from the water. I'd worry about all these projects that we were working on, all the technical work I needed to do to understand what we were supposed to do, but I'd want to escape all the time into the lake and kayak. And in that process, I learned so much about nature. I learned so much about the beaver. I learned so much about balance, about energy. I would come back and report to William intriguing things like when I thought my kayak would go in this direction, it would move in its own direction. Then all of a sudden, I'd see seven loons. And he'd tell me about energy and, you know, trusting the energy of the world of nature. Anyway, the intriguing thing to me was, by the end of that summer, I felt I had grown so much more clever than I'd been before. I felt like my mind had been exfoliated by nature, and it was something that he knew I needed to experience, though he never really explained it to me in that kind of way. So the journey motif was embedded in his canoe heritage, and it became also very much a part of our own life. We drove through much of the American Northeast. We drove around the Great Lakes, and one intriguing experience was when we went to Minnesota. We ended up going to Pipestone, and it was the last day of the annual sun dance that the American Indian Movement people held at Pipestone. We arrived there on the fourth day of the dance in the afternoon, really late, around 4. And it was really intriguing because as we arrived, the eagle arrived. And the leader there, who knew William, Clyde Belcourt, said, "Wow, we've been waiting for a sign from the Creator for 8 days, the 4 days of preparation and the 4 days of the dancing." And he said to the younger people there, "And our Creator has sent us a sign. Here is our leader from the East." And what he was alluding to was not just the fact that William's significance as a spiritual leader was being recognized. He was also a very independent political leader. So during the 1940s, around about the time when the United Nations was first established, he worked very closely with an indigenous activist, Joe Siwi. And they worked hard to create the North American Indian Nations government. At that stage, the oppression of indigenous peoples, both in Canada and the United States, was considerable. These two and other Native leaders gathered together to raise awareness of the presence, the need, the voice, the aspirations, gathered together indigenous peoples to assert their rights to their lands and their resources. That effort at political independence continued for, all of William's life, I would say, but very formally till the 70s. He was a chief at his own community for over 19 years, almost 20 years, but always chief by acclamation. He was an old-style chief. If the communities wanted him to serve them, then he served them, but he never really ran for any chiefs and any leadership roles. So that made him a little bit different than other indigenous leaders. Also, he became the supreme chief of the North American Indian Nations government, and so through that process affirmed his connection with both Canada and the U.S. He considered both countries really his Turtle Island, his homeland, and so his relationship with both sides of the border was seamless. In fact, in 1995, he served as elder for the Sunbow 5 Walk for Mother Earth, a walk with indigenous and non-indigenous people commencing at First Encounter Beach in Boston, and over a 7.5-month period, people walked to Santa Barbara, California, to raise awareness about environmental issues and indigenous issues. William served as spiritual guide for that that walk, and so it was really interesting that it was an elder from Canada who actually trekked across the United States. In this process, he offered prayer and ceremony at multiple interesting places, including at the site where Martin Luther King was shot. And that makes me remember to tell you then that William worked very hard to promote racial harmony. Just recently we acknowledged Martin Luther King Day here in Canada, and a few years ago an organization presented him with the Martin Luther King Dreamkeeper Award. But they didn't realize that many years earlier, during the Sunbow 5 walk, William had done a pipe ceremony in Memphis, sort of praying for that that activist. In 2000, he hosted an international peace gathering in the capital city of Canada, and had representatives from the Rosa Parks Institute participate. Along the way, he became a recipient of a Wolf Award. The Wolf Project being one that honored people who advanced racial harmony. William actually was presented with the Aurora Borealis, North Star Wolf. Nelson Mandela was presented with the Southern Star. Another recipient of the Wolf Award was Chief Arvo Looking Horse. Streams of honors that William received in terms of his peace-building work were things like the Harmony Award, etc. Okay, so I'm rambling all over the place.
No, that's okay.
Okay, doing great.
Wouldn't it be interesting to do a man... I'd like to hear a line of reading on his birth. And it was really interesting. The reason why is back before, back in 2009, when I was homeless for 15 months, I was on the phone with Red Elk, and I was telling him about Torah portion readings from the Hebrew Bible. And in the Hebrew way, for holy men, it's really interesting to read both their birth and death dates, reading from the Torah. And was really interesting. He gave me his birth date. I went and looked at the Torah reading, and he had the very same reading as a very, very, probably one of the most famous Hebrew holy men of our time, Menachem Schneerson, New York. And it was literally that he was the kind of person that would bring heaven down to earth. And that's exactly what Red Oak did for all his many years, you know, beginning in Detroit when, you know, he worked as a car artist and he went at night and intervened between gangs and gang wars and so forth. And if we've got time, well, if you'd like to, let's do
it. Do you want to do a quick, I've got it punched up, so I'm ready to go.
Yeah,
for sure. That sounds very interesting.
We'll do it real quick. And the reason I'm figured out it was a pretty good idea to do this, Otter, is because his birth and her birth are going to connect. And his birth, November 11th, 1913, that day in the traditional Mayan day count was a 9 ahau. Remember we said yours was 13 ahau?
Yeah.
Well, you guys connect on the ahau glyph. And not only that, but if his is sitting in the cycle of ebb, remember the other thing when I said the forward flow of time?
Yeah.
That's on that glyph. Ebb. That was a 3 ebb. So there's two connections there with you. It's connecting very strongly, especially if you ever had anything showing up, especially with the color yellow, you know, which would be in the Mayan tradition, that would be in the south. Okay, let me pull up the other one here and see what the sixth sun says about him. There was something I already know because I've looked his up before. His in the forward flow of time has warrior energy.
Warrior energy.
Reason, justice. Remember the thing you said about service?
Yes.
His is here too. Same thing. And his is in chorus. Yours was Khan energy, Pleiades stuff. His was with Lamont. And Lamont is also called, in the Mayan, Lamont is also associated as morning star.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So on the backward flow of time, his is a 12 Taj or Malak, and yours was a 12 Shakan. And Shakan is a red glyph, and Malak is the next red glyph after it. And the number is the same, 12. So your numbers here are matching exactly. Your glyphs are a little bit different. The colors are sort of the same, but they're different glyphs. But now, what's interesting about this, when you're talking earlier, kind of a little message was popping in my head to have you, if he didn't ever say anything to you already, maybe you can ask him about what the Hopi call purification. Because this particular thing on his birth, on the backward flow of time, coming back from the next world cycle, one of the things it connects into is purification, but it also relates to water, not just regular water, but universal water.
Okay.
And his is also the community, you know, that thing I told you about, community and cooperation?
Yeah,
That's here, too. And his partnering energy in here is Shakan, which was your glyph in the same position. Yours was a 12 Shakan, his is 12 Mulak, but his is connecting up, and his is the 12th day of the Hu Neb Khu cycle of harmony. And
okay.
It's in another bigger cycle, which is about oneness. Now, where these two come together, remember yours was what I said was the radial spiraling light and peace?
Right.
His is the radial spiraling light, number 15, that's the day number 15, so his has that same thing, but his glyph is not the peace glyph, his glyph is the balance glyph.
Okay.
His is about completion of things, expanding power, balance and correct actions, the spiraling radial type of light that Creator uses. And the partnering energy here is things about soul, joy, and forgiveness.
Okay.
That's
Mark?
His. Yeah.
Is there a connection with the number 9 with Quetzalcoatl, or does it work that way?
Oh yeah, because you're a 9-eek, right?
Yeah, I just
that's one of Quetzalcoatl's day signs, 9-eek.
Yeah, that's right.
What that relates to is the 9 in the Maya tradition is the Bolantiku, or the 9 underworlds.
Okay.
And there's the 9 underworlds and the 13 heavens. And when you unite the two, 13 plus 9 is 22.
22.
Day number 22 in the Mayan Zolcan is 9-eek, day sign of Quetzalcoatl. Also day sign of Blue Otter.
Of Blue Otter?
That's me.
Everything is connected.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
But the thing here that's coming up to me that popped into my head earlier was, I don't know why, it didn't make sense to me, but it was like Spirit was telling, ask her to ask if Commander talked about purification, or if maybe she needs to ask him if he didn't say anything. Maybe she needs to ask him now to see what he says. Or not now necessarily, but, you know, sometime in the next few weeks or wherever you get around to it.
Okay. Well, in 1998, we hosted a gathering of the indigenous prophecy holders. Okay, so another huge and critically important part of William's story is, forgiveness and the sacred wampum bells. Okay. Let me start off by saying, became very ill when he was in his late 40s, ended up having cancer, and was really pretty well on his deathbed. Came down to maybe 98 pounds. And then when he was in so much of pain one morning, he recalls waking up on the Chesterfield, hearing a bird singing at his window. And he said the bird sang so piercingly, so beautifully, his tears started to fall. He couldn't stop crying. And he realized, he knew it was not a bird. It was not just a bird. It was his connection with his creator. And he said to him, I am in so much of pain. Take me now, right now, unless there's something you want me to do. And I guess at this point, this period of his life, he was working hard for his community, working hard to rally together the indigenous. He was, he was a kindergarten dropout. I wrote a book about him, and I called him a kindergarten dropout. But in fact, William was self-taught. He had a huge library of books where he, made notes about every part of the history of the Americans of the Turtle Island. He was also like a kind of person who watched the news 3 or 4 times a day, so he was very immersed in global news. Anyway, he was well attuned to the oppression, the near genocide of his own people, and the frustration of all the efforts to find their rightful place amongst all the colonizing influences. Anyway, all of these factors, I think, contributed to this illness. But at this point then, he made this commitment to his creator to serve in some different fashion. And he then underwent a period of healing. His wife and another medicine woman prepared native medicines, plant medicines for him. He had the support of Belgian naturopath. And another intriguing part of his healing journey was this process of self-determination. He was chief of his community, and the police brought representatives from Scotland Yard to come and visit him. And he showed them his craft-making shop, because, as I said earlier, he was a canoe maker. He made snowshoes. He did other things besides doing his job as a veneer log selector for, at one stage, warehouser. And other than doing his job as chief of the community, did his craft. So he showed them his workshop, and they asked who this this pair of snowshoes was being created for. He said it was for him, and they kind of shook their heads because they saw a dying man in front of them. You know, he was so thin. But really, I realized later that focus on the next stage in his journey is what also contributed to his health. But it was this huge commitment to his creator, and that commitment was around creating peace. So his wife said, I mean, after this period, what's happened to you? You're not fighting about everything anymore. You've just become quite a different person. Yes, he had launched into his active peace-building mode. So then he began to gather indigenous peoples together, the native people from both Canada and the U.S. He started off with gatherings. And, Mac, I think we talked about the 1969 gathering he hosted at his home in Maniwaki when Mad Bear Anderson joined him there. But he'd already hosted another gathering in Eganville in 1967. And so that began the process of the peace-building outreach to indigenous peoples. And then over the years, it became things like the Sun Bowl 5 Walk. And during the last 15, 20 years of his life, he held gatherings at his home in Maniwaki with huge consistency. So all of this was his huge effort to raise awareness about environmental issues, the crises that he saw looming, to create racial harmony and peace building. So yes, indeed, peace was very much a part of his effort. But what I meant to say was, at this time of this illness, he learned the importance of forgiveness. And so he would tell people, you know, you have to learn, we have to learn how to forgive ourselves. And when we're able to forgive ourselves for our own shortcomings, for the things we may not have done as well as we ought to have, then we'll find the capacity to forgive others. And so that became very much a part of his teachings, the spiritually inspired teaching. Okay, so then we move to organizing this... 10 years after that, he became the holder of the sacred wampum bells. These are artifacts of historical, spiritual, record-making importance. And that is a huge story unto itself. But one of the wampum bells was the Seven Fire Prophecy Wampum Belt, and many people considered that William was the prophecy carrier during the time of the Seventh Fire Prophecy, the unfolding of the prophecy. He was also the carrier of a three-figure wampum belt, where he says the Indian in the center welcomed the newcomers, these being the French and the English in the old days, to his country, agreeing to share the grand natural resources in equitable portions, and with the commitment that the values of the indigenous would guide the evolving nations. At this stage, his people were talking on behalf of the entire continent of North America, remembering, of course, that these are the people of the East, the first people that the newcomers would have met in the 1700s. And his statement was that because his ancestors had welcomed the newcomers, he was committed to continue that welcome. And so his outreach of peace was to all peoples who were now occupying Turtle Island, his homeland. And he always sought to see the values of the indigenous center in the evolution of this country, the countries, even though he never really saw that manifest during his lifetime. But he still affirmed that value. And for him, the two critical values were respect for Mother Earth, respect for indigenous wisdom, and respecting that we're all connected, that we're all related. So his prayer, constant prayer, was use of this word, Jinawi Daganuk. We're all connected. And it was his message that he continued to affirm till he moved on. Well, in that 98 period, William and the Wolf Project organized a gathering of the indigenous prophecy keepers. And so we invited Arvo Looking Horse, who was then the carrier of the White Buffalo Calf Woman's Pipe, as well as, and now I finally come to it, Martin Gashwa Sioma, the Hopi elder, the late Martin. Now, William had known him for many years. William had actually gone and visited Martin in Hotavilla. And I'm just remembering a story I'll tell you. You know, Martin was planting corn in his fields, and it was very hot. It was dry. William was with him. He'd take his stick. He'd make a hole in the ground and put in a kernel of corn in, and, you know, put in his medicine and say a prayer. And it was hot, and William offered to help him. But Martin says, no, this is something I have to do myself. And I think that's a critically important message. And it was very much also the way William Commander lived his life. He did everything himself. You know, if it was time to roll up the hoses because it was summer was over and you know, winter was coming, he went out and did that. He worked really, I would say, from the time he was 7 or 8, when he was polishing shoes doing chores as a little child, till the actual day he died. And he died at the age of 98 on the eve of his gathering. He continued to work throughout his life in this kind of way where he put his hands to everything. I mean, it's incredible to reflect on it, just how hard he worked. Now, to go back to the idea of the purification, that connection with Martin, that a link with the tablets that the Hopi elder, you know, was responsible for, were all part of his teachings. But you're right. I probably need to understand better the idea of the purification, but William probably would have much more strongly than I.
Wow, what a fantastic life.
Yeah, and actually I want to tell you something else then, since you're so interested in the since your show is a prophecy carrier. I don't know if you heard of or familiar with Navajo elder Grandfather Martin Martinez.
I'm not.
No, me neither.
Okay, he's from the Four Mountains portion of Arizona, and we met him there in Santa Fe some years ago. He was a spiritual leader, much like Martin Gashwa Sioma and Grandfather Commander. And I recall that he created and presented Grandfather Commander with a sacred cane. That is a special story unto itself. But what was so interesting was the ceremonial way he sang his songs in passing this the sacred item over, you know. So in that energy too was the hope and the prayer of the indigenous faith holders, spirit holders, for some shift in the energetic reality of the world as we've come to know it. And of course, peace was then very much the mission for William Commander. Which then leads me to his kind of ongoing work. Okay, so you mentioned water, and indeed you are right. Water featured, of course, all the four elements were critically important and a critical part of William's teachings. But the water especially, because, of course, his canoe heritage, the fact that he was Algonquin of the Ottawa River watershed, the fact that the rivers and the lakes were the highways of his people, the fact that they are the people of the eastern seaboard, and the ancestral energies from thousands of years ago would have linked with the maritime culture, the maritime navigators of the post Wisconsin Ice Age. So anyway, water features in a big way, and we organized gatherings focused on water during his annual Circle of All Nations gatherings. One in 2004, in 2006 we hosted a gathering in the city of Ottawa to wake up the city to the absolute pollution of the waters right here. But in this process, William worked to protest damming at the sacred Chaudière Falls. So now that brings me to another huge part of his story. Okay. In the heart of the territory of the Algonquins, right here in the capital city, we have the Ottawa River. Oh, and that's a special story unto itself, because the Ottawa River is, I think maybe about this, used to be about the second wildest river in North America, because it had so many rapids. It traverses rocks that were created during four different periods in the Earth's creation. So it has, in the course of its pathway, rocks representative of each of these special periods in this earth-building process. So it's very special. But as the river flows from the west to the east, it at the capital city, we have a circular waterfall, the Chaudière Falls. Akik Pautik is what William called it, a bucket-shaped rapid. And it's intriguing what you said earlier about the counterclockwise spin of the morning star.
Well, actually, it's clockwise. The rest of them are going counterclockwise. Well, it depends on your perception, which way you look at it.
No, but you're right. But I meant, like you meant, it was different from the way the rest of it was spinning. And in a kind of intriguing way, the water spins at this sacred Chaudière site. Mm-hmm. There are some islands alongside of it, and from historical times, is acknowledged to be a meeting place, a spiritual meeting place of indigenous people. Spiritual because when they were first observed there, they were doing tobacco ceremony. But archaeological explorations have indicated that people were here 6,000 years ago, people were here 2,500 years ago, people were here 500 years ago. So it shows a consistent pattern of presence. And in the tools that are found, it shows for one thing that they were in fact nomads for thousands of years, because there was copper from like Lake Superior here in the Ottawa site. And it also shows sort of like the focus on the tool making, the creative tool making. And of course, that lines up with the petroglyph and pictograph heritage of the people in this part of the country. Well, all over, of course, North America, but, you know, I'm thinking here. Anyway, Grandfather Commander, whose ancestors I trace really to this particular spot, envisioned a healing and peace-building center at this place. An indigenous center drawing together the native people from across the country so that the people will heal, reconcile their differences, and become the strong people that would serve as the center of that three-figure wampum belt. But also people who would open up their arms in friendship to all the newcomers like their ancestors did, like Grandfather Commander did. And so in that sense, this sacred site at the circular waterfalls would also then be a peace-building center, sort of a counterbalance to the endless wars that he saw from really the moment of his birth, and that he saw only escalating after 9/11. He also envisioned an eco-think tank so that the best thinking in terms of environmental issues would be explored there by thinking people. And in his time, you know, Grandfather objected to things like the uranium mining, like the damming, like the mega dumps, the kind of exploitation of the dolphins and whales. He was passionate about the endless tree cutting. When he was involved in that in early lumber business, he was trying very much to inculcate the values of select use of trees, not envisaging the kind of devastation that would have that had really actually already happened, but was continued to happen with the trees throughout the continent. He'd say, you know, as we drove to his home in Maniwaki all the time and we watched all the logging trucks up and down his territory, say it feels like a needle piercing my eye every time I see these logging trucks go by. And of course, now we realize just how devastated our global world is because of these kinds of things. Anyway, all that to say, here at this sacred Shaudia Falls, Ottawa being, I think, the only capital city that has a circular waterfall, we are hoping to see the manifestation of the William Commander vision. The area was highly industrialized and developed, contributing, I think, to the sort of the development of the country in the 1800s and 1900s. But he envisioned the public space, sort of a Central Park, New York, you know, a return to nature, and the dammed Shaudia Falls undammed to the extent possible. Unfortunately, that vision has not yet materialized, and right now we're facing a lot of difficulty because there are development interests in this area. So we're challenging plans to put up condominium and sort of European malls in what native and non-native people would like to see as the indigenous healing and peace-building center with reconciliation amongst indigenous peoples, all others, and reconciliation with sort of Mother Earth and the waters as taking its rightful place in the capital city. So William is very much engaged in the water energy, in the peace energy, in the forgiveness energy, and shining a light to something else.
Wow, and, you have a phenomenal memory, ma'am.
Well, as I say, I've been colonized. I've been well indoctrinated by William, and of course, I've worked on many of these things because I had the huge fortune, I guess, to get to understand it so well, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah. So. And I mean, the William Commander story is endless. And even as I'm looking to the challenge, I'm exploring the land ownership issues at this area, you know, because we consider that this area here is unceded, unsurrendered, and unconquered Algonquin territory. Even as I'm looking at archival material, so I put my hands to a file, like, you know, right here at home, and I find messages handwritten by William Commander, messages talking about the 1940s, the visits to the United Nations, the raising of awareness about indigenous issues from that time period. I recall, you know, him talking about the transitions in leadership. I think, you know, from a period when Native people were totally ignored to when their independent voice was appropriated and, you know, sort of made subject to the larger kind of control interests. So, yeah, so... Even as much as I know, I lay my hand on a book and I'm learning more. And books annotated by William, notes written by him. So yeah, his reach was tremendous.
Well, we're so grateful that you're walking in his footsteps, and I know you're making some waves of your own here in this life, and. Much appreciated, and I did want to. I don't know whether Mac Boogaloo told you how Prophecy Keepers got started, but back in 1985, I knew who Mad Bear was because Rolling Thunder was a friend of mine, and
okay.
I never saw a picture of Mad Bear until 1996, but in 1985. A man appeared to me in a dream, and he had a white stone around his neck. It was a translucent white stone, and there was a key embedded in the stone, and his name was written in the stone, but I wasn't allowed to remember the name. And we were just sitting from a long, low table, and he had a round face, pockmarked skin, and he just said to me, when are you going to do something about, and then he mentioned the man that I knew was my Cherokee 7th great-grandfather. He said, when are you going to do something about Gardner Green's genealogy? And that was it. And I had been given my Cherokee genealogy when I was 16, and
okay.
at that time I had just passed 30. Well, fast forward to 1996, after my first wife passed away, there was a little life insurance money, and I bought a computer, got on the internet, and I had been, at that time, and for many years, I've been collecting prophecies and put them together in a 32-page newsletter. I just gave it out to people. I said, here, you know, copy it, give it out to people, whatever. Within 6 months, I was getting letters from Australia and different places saying, hey, we'd like to see some more. So I learned how to build websites and got on the internet and I've done a lot of things since then. But along the way somewhere, right about the time I got on the internet, I was living in Moab, Utah, and I went into a bookstore, and I finally was able to get a copy of the book Mad Bear. And I'd had Doug Boyd's book Rolling Thunder for quite some time. And then I saw Mad Bear's picture, and I said, oh, my gosh, that's him. And then I opened up and found out, you know, when he died in 85. And shortly after he walked west is when I saw him. And a lady named Marcine Quenzer, an artist, he visited her after he walked west and asked her to do a series of paintings that had to do with the wampums and the Great Law and so forth. And you can kind of read about that at whiterootsofpeace.com. You can see whiterootsofpeace.com. You can read Marcine's, you can see the artwork but these elders, shortly after my Cherokee elder friend John Red Hat passed away, I had a dream where I was driving a semi in near the area where he lived in Colorado, and I was going to make a delivery up a mountain. And I started, you know, if you're going to take a truck, you don't back it up a mountain. Well, I started to do that, and all of a sudden, he appeared and threw open the door and says, move over. He says, I'm backing you up. So anyway, these elders, they're around, and they're more powerful now than they ever thought of being in mortality, but... We're almost out of time, and if you have any websites or contact information you'd like to give out, I guess you're at there is a website on here, asinabka.com, I guess it is.
Yes, Asinabka. It pertains to the work at the Sacred Shaudia site, and it's primarily focused on that. We'd be very interested if people are interested in grandfather's work and vision. To send messages to our leadership, you know, because we see this as an international center, and we do hope it will manifest soon. I also have a kind of old-fashioned Circle of All Nations website that contains much historical information. And I'll say I'm going to school right now studying grandfather. I'm studying geography, and I'm looking to see his footprints on his map. I'm looking to map him on his land, and I'm studying the relevance of his discourse. And so it's really very meaningful to me that you folk have been interested in him and in connecting with me, because it affirms that the legacy is still alive, the discourse is still alive, and that he still matters. Well, congratulations on all the amazing work you guys are doing.
It keeps us going.
Yeah, fascinating.
Well, thank you so much for making an appearance. Hope to meet you in the flesh someday.
Yeah, that will be a real pleasure, and maybe it'll be at Williams Center. But we look forward to that.
Right. And Mark, did you have anything to add?
No. Well, there was one thing that popped up when we were talking about before, and that is something came up, and that is when William was going through that problem and trying to heal himself and stuff,
yeah.
One of the things that came up was that some of your energy from the future actually went backward in time and helped him to heal.
Really?
Yeah, your birth connections are—they're not identical, but they're very close and certain a lot of harmonics. And on that backward flow of time, that's where it seemed to suggest to me anyway, that when he was doing that healing, that what you've been doing actually boosted his work in the future, which helped him to heal himself in the past so he could do what he did, if that makes sense.
That's the way it works with Hebrews.
Well, it does make sense to me. I mean, I wouldn't say it had you not said that, but his loss.
I'm not saying yours was the soul energy, but it was a contributing factor.
Yeah, wow. Could I just ask you, Venus, does that figure in any of your knowledge of the stars? Or,
well, Venus, Venus
has a... Do you consider that
the
morning star or not?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, actually, all over the whole planet, most of the cultures and traditions call it the morning star. That's their name for it.
Okay,
and
okay.
It's also, though, it has something to do. Venus and Earth have a very direct, exact relationship on their orbital pattern. They exactly match a certain pattern in creation that we call the golden ratio. And it is everywhere else, too, but it's just extremely obvious between Earth and Venus. It's exact. And so it's no subharmonics or anything. It's pretty black and white. And that pattern is highly significant. So it's one of the things that, you know, when you say you go out and learn from nature and stuff, it is a pattern that literally is built all over nature, everything in nature, from the DNA, and even sub-DNA, all the way up to the shape of the galaxy. So stuff is determined by it. So Venus and Earth demonstrate that relationship very precisely. And if you look at it, it's formed by three numbers, 5, 8, and 13. And that's the ratio between Earth and Venus, and how many years Earth versus Venus. And those numbers also happen to be numbers of the one that they, and a long time ago, that came to Americas, including the Algonquins, of the one they called the Great Healer or Great Peacemaker or whatever.
Right.
Name. He too was also associated with the morning star or the dawn star.
Okay.
And they also said those were his numbers. So when you see numbers like 5, 8, and 13 show up, like remember you said the sun dance?
Yeah.
4 days preparation, 4 days ceremony, 8.
Yeah.
8 is the number in the Mayans, the 8th glyph is Lamont, which is the morning star glyph.
Okay.
So when William showed up on the 8th day, he was literally showing up on the morning star day of that ceremony.
Wow.
So, yeah. But, yeah, there's a lot.
Because just in a totally kind of foolish and romantic kind of way, just because my name happens to be Romola, it's actually an Italian name, though I myself am Indian, the other kind, the wrong kind. But because it's that name, I've traced the roots of that Romola name all the way to Aphrodite.
Hey, folks, we're out of time, and we're out of stream in a few seconds, so we'll have to say goodbye.
Well, thank you so much for this conversation and for sharing the stuff about the Mayan heritage.
And thank you so much for making an appearance. Well, good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Night.
Bye-bye now.
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library, which includes lifetime online access to a printable 1,000-page intelligence briefing and a worldwide indigenous prophecy encyclopedia. Now, folks, there's nothing else like this collection on the planet, all for $9.99, formerly priced at $29.99.
You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files and 222 folders. It includes the Prophecy Keeper's Prepper's Self-Reliance files and all of our previous over 100 Prophecy Keepers interviews. So head on over to prophecykeepers.com right now and have a free sneak peek today of two-thirds of the Prophecy Keepers trilogy and a peek of the dashboard of the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault. Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
You want to get an edge on turning back the clock with just a few pills? Who doesn't? Well, it's no longer science fiction, but science possibility, a potential breakthrough. As I found out firsthand, there may be a way to erase years, at least